Today's Teisho will be on case 38 in the Book of Serenity. Case 38 is entitled Lin Ji's True Person. Introduction. Taking a thief for one's own son, taking the servant for the master, can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? Lin Ji said to the assembly, "There is a true person with no rank, always going out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look." Then a monk came forward and said, "What is the true person of no rank?" Lin Ji got down from the seat, grabbed him and held him. The monk hesitated. Lin Ji pushed him away and said, "The true person of no rank. What a piece of dry crap he is." Verse, delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and sand can't be cleared away. Clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring. If suddenly it burst forth, it would flow freely. I want to thank everybody for doing a marvelous job, a magnificent job, in the Zendo this morning. We have 23 people here today, all of them sitting very still at 6 o'clock in the morning for 3 periods of meditation. I look forward to those morning sits quite a bit. There's something about getting up in the morning early with fewer preoccupations, fewer distractions. Maybe in our sleep we've worked through some of our problems. And we come to the cushion in the morning and the early morning sits are really quite wonderful. Really, really quite wonderful. By the time we get to the third sit, we've concentrated our minds and we've concentrated our energy. There's great stillness but great attention, at least ideally. Some people might be just dozing off on the cushion, but ideally, when it all comes together, there's great stillness, and great mental focus. And there's a kind of power that arises in that moment, in those moments, which is really quite extraordinary and hard to equal, I think, throughout the rest of the day. For beginners, it's really challenging to do 3 sits like that in a row, but sooner or later, I think you'll notice that there's something quite special about that. And everybody today seemed to be open to the experience. Everybody seemed to be prepared to be open-hearted in that way. And there was this great stillness and power in the room. It was really impressive. So I thank you for doing such an excellent job. This is Sesshin. And it's a really amazing invention. Sesshin is like a machine for waking up. And it's quite different from anything else that I know. Some people come here and it's just not their cup of tea. That does happen, you know. People come here and they don't like to get up early. This much zazen is a big challenge for them. There's pain in your knees. And some people just can't do it. And I have, if by day two or three you just can't do it, please understand that, you know, there are people who have left and come back. There are people who have gone away and never come back. But if this resonates with you, if this experience resonates with you, it's really unlike anything else. You know, this is a machine for waking up. People for more than 1,000 years, actually for thousands of years, think about that. People for thousands of years have been doing sesshin, probably since the time of the Buddha himself. So it's about 2,500 years. People have been assembling and sitting like this in this very concentrated schedule with great dedication, great devotion, and mental focus, and raising their energy and overcoming their barriers. It's really extraordinary. So a little earlier in the session, I talked about the fact that, you know, outside, in the world outside session, the goals are very different from here. You know, our civilization, our culture, isn't really based on producing enlightened, compassionate people. It has many different goals, and some of them are noble, and some of them are not so noble. You know, so you know, basically, people I know who work in New York spend a lot of time trying to make other people envious and unhappy. As a matter of fact, I was before Sesshin, I came. I had the chance to watch Mad Men, the reruns of Mad Men, on Netflix. And everybody I know has been raving about Mad Men. Unfortunately, my evenings are very busy doing Zazen. So I haven't seen Mad Men. And so I got to watch the reruns on Netflix. And I saw the first one. I was really quite impressed, you know. I was really blown away almost. I thought it was so well done, you know. And I have a friend at work who works for the English department. His name is Dan, and he is an old madman. He's 75 years old, and he works for the English department part time, promoting some of our English department initiatives. So we actually have a retired Madison Avenue guy pitching some of our stuff, and he's seen the show, and he says that is so real. Mm-hmm. He's somehow made it to 75 with all that smoking and everything. But the point is, you know, the people spend millions and millions of dollars thinking, how can we make people crave something they don't really need and that will probably be bad for them? Yes. And make them feel unhappy about themselves if they don't have it, you know. And I think that's really remarkable, you know. And somebody like the hero of Mad Men, Don Draper, is you know, he's an incredibly handsome guy. I thought, wow, you know. But he's so tormented, right? Because he has a conscience, and he kind of knows that what he's doing is not necessarily good. He works in this office where people are really very crude spirited, you know. And I can see that, you know, there's going to be a lot of drama in this show, you know. I've only seen one episode so far. And I was watching it with my wife, and she refused to watch it. She said this is, the sexism drove her crazy. She couldn't stand it anymore. But I thought it was fascinating, you know. On the way down here, I was listening to a radio program on NPR, and there was a person talking about going to Shenzhen in China. And 50 years ago, Shenzhen was a fishing village. There was nothing there but a fishing village. And today, it's the biggest manufacturing hub in China. This American, who speaks Chinese, and he was in Shenzhen, and he was just looking at how people live in Shenzhen. And it has all the conventional hallmarks of a highly advanced society. But people, you know, are really working very, very hard under really difficult conditions. And he described going into this factory that makes, IMAX, I guess, or one of those devices, one of those little, not the iPad, maybe it's an iPad, making iPads. And he talks about going into this factory where these women sit on these assembly lines and they assemble iPads for 12 hours a day. And they have to clean the screens with a chemical that is very, very toxic, very carcinogenic. And he said, in some cases, their hands shake when they're working with this chemical. And he said, you know, we like to think that in the old days people made things by hand. And he said, more things are made by hand now than ever in human history. And he just talked about how these people live. And you realize, you know, so much of our energy and time go into things that are non-essential. In fact, they're actually bad for us, you know. And it was sad because, you know, the Chinese people used to have a very different way of life. I was reading this article about this by a British guy, and he went to Hong Kong? Yes, he went to Hong Kong. And he left the madness of the city, and he drove up into the hills, and he found this little town, this little village, which was like an old-style Chinese village. And it wasn't a tourist stop. It was people who were actually living their lives as they would have 100 years ago. And he said, you know, there was a, you know, people, the pace of life was very different. People were sitting around on this plaza having tea. There were cages, bamboo cages with little birds in the cages singing. And it was like there was no tomorrow, right? Just this moment. And he was utterly transfixed by this scene. He said this was like another way of life, you know, outside of this madness of Hong Kong. Our society has done wonderful things too, you know, really wonderful things. Before Sashin, I had an ear infection. And I went to the doctor and he gave me some drops and I've been putting them in my ear. My ear is, you know, feels much better, you know, really, you know, that wouldn't have been possible a century ago. I asked my doctor, what would have happened a century ago if we didn't have antibiotics? And he said, well, you probably would have had this forever, you know. I'm glad, you know, glad to get rid of it. We have some good things. I'm not knocking the modern world, but our values and goals are not necessarily healthy ones all the time. But when you come to Sashin, the whole purpose of Sashin is to help you wake up. So from the Buddhist standpoint, this is like going to the gym, right, and building your body up and improving your health. A teacher I know called this Karma Hospital, coming to Karma Hospital to clean up your karma and purify body, mind, and heart. Everything about Sashin is designed to do this. It's designed to help you be here now, fully in the moment. So, you know, we get up in the morning, you have to report here by 5 o'clock. So you come in, you sit down, and we start reciting sutras. And even the sutras are designed to help you become mindful and attentive to the moment. So you have to focus on each syllable, and they're clipping right along, and somebody's beating a wooden fish, beating the mo-yu, and the mokugyo, and you have to keep pace, and you have to focus. And, you know, you can't think about yourself. You can't think, how does my hair look? You know, how do I, you know, you have to keep pace. Pretty soon you're in the rhythm, and you're breathing with your hara, and your mind's right on the moment, right on the present moment. You know, and this is really like healthy. You don't have time to ruminate. You don't have time to lose yourself in thoughts of regret or fantasies about the future. You just have to be in this syllable 100%. So I think sesshin is like nothing else in the world, and I think it's an amazing, wonderful thing. The days are going to go by very quickly, even though the minutes may sometimes seem interminable. The days are going to go by very quickly, and you will notice that your obstacles and your heavy burdens fall away. And you're going to feel much freer and much, much lighter. And the non-essentials are going to be obviously non-essentials, and the essentials are going to be very clear and present. And that's going to be wonderful. So in that sense, you know, sesshin is just this marvelous, precious opportunity. People spend their days tossing and turning on their beds, you know, lost in regret, thoughts of what might have been, and burning with anxiety or hunger when they turn their minds to the future. And people are constantly comparing themselves to one another and finding themselves wanting and this sort of thing. But when you come to sesshin, you focus the mind on the moment, minute by minute, hour by hour. Pretty soon, all of these things seem unimportant, and then life becomes quite alive. Or, you know, the life becomes quite different, really transformed. The world, which almost seems incidental and almost passes us by in a haze, or normally we're so focused in our mental worlds, we're so caught up in our projections and our compulsive thoughts, that the world is sort of, it's like, what did I have breakfast? What did I eat for breakfast? You know, or you're driving to work and you can't remember. I'm sure it's happened to you. I mean, it's happened to me. I miss a turn. You know, I've driven this thing 20,000 times, but I missed a turn. You know, where was my mind? It wasn't here in the moment. It was lost in reverie or lost in thought, you know. And the world is like an incidental or ghost-like, you know. But here, at sesshin, you know, if you're in the moment, the thoughts begin to recede, and it's like an alternative consciousness. The thoughts begin to recede, and then the presentness of things becomes very powerful and healing, and very sustaining. You know? So one dimension of sesshin is simply the cultivation of mindfulness. You know, gradually the torrent of thought and the illusion machine slows down and almost comes to a stop. And when we're not projecting madly onto the world and we turn our attention to it, this usually takes place around day two or day three, suddenly it leaps to life in the most wonderful way. You know, so, you know, many millions of people in New Jersey got up this morning and they may or may not have noticed the sunlight. You know, they might have, you know, they have business and it's legitimate. You know, I myself, you know, I have things I have to do. And they're good. They're not bad. They give me a chance to be helpful to others and be creative and so on and so on. But, you know, sometimes I'm so busy, the world is just like a ghost. And you know, I get to work and, you know, I'm so wrapped up in what I have to do when I get there, I don't notice anything. But it's wonderful to be able to be in the moment 100%. That's your job for the day. And when you do this, everything becomes so alive. But there's another dimension to Zen practice too that I want to say something about. And that is that our minds really are out of balance in another way. They're not just distracted, but we have a conscious mind, which is this thinking mind, and we have an unconscious mind, that is this really amazing intelligence. The conscious mind is a separating intelligence. It's a separating intelligence. It divides us from other things. As soon as you begin to think in a verbal mode, or in a discursive mode, analyzing or comparing, you begin to feel your sense of isolation from the object of your attention. And this is part of what it means to be a human being. And you should develop your discriminating mind as fully as you can. So, it's important to read, it's important to think, it's important to acquire new skills. All of those things are good, not bad. But, we tend to become unbalanced. We tend to become unbalanced in the modern world. We put so much value on the discriminating mind, on the verbal thinking of intelligence. And it creates a kind of divided society, or an unbalanced society, where we lose track of what's really important. And sometimes if we spend too much time in the discriminating mind, the world can begin to feel very dead or dull, or it can be a very disorienting place. So mindfulness is part of Zen practice, but another part of Zen practice is tapping into this other unconscious mind, this other unconscious intelligence, which is not a separating or a discriminating intellect, but it's a unifying intellect. So when you're sitting on the cushion on day one, you might still be thinking about all the things that are going on in your life. Maybe you have a financial problem. And you're coming to Sesshin, and it's possible to sit for many hours rehearsing your problem and worrying about it, even though you can't solve it right now. You might feel obliged to turn it over in your mind again and again. That you're blocked in your work in some way. There's a problem you can't solve, and the consequences are scary for you. So, you can sit on the cushion and relive that. And of course, when you do that, you'll just have a lot of anxiety, But if you keep pulling your mind back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath, by maybe the end of day one or somewhere in day two, You'll realize that these details are not something you can deal with now, and you'll just let them go, and you'll begin to feel much better. You begin to feel much free. It's like you can suddenly breathe. Like there's a weight off your chest. And if you keep coming back to the moment, even if your legs hurt and even if you're very tired, I think you'll notice sooner or later that things have this liveliness I talked about. You begin to feel better. And things just seem a little crisper and a little more fully present. On the cushion, there's this other process that's going on besides mindfulness, which is that you're beginning to, when you're relaxed and you're not thinking, it permits the operation of this other part of your mind, which is the unconscious mind that experiences the world as part of yourself. Usually around day three, people begin to have these experiences where things like sunlight on the ground, which would have just been unremarkable, become very gripping. You can't make it happen, but you might suddenly notice you're looking at the sunlight on the ground, and it's as though your whole consciousness becomes the sunlight. Or maybe you hear a bird song, and it's as though the bird song is part of yourself. Sometimes people experience the world this way. They don't necessarily say, "Oh, the bird song is part of myself." But you just hear the song and your consciousness is 100% bird song. And you might also begin to feel this sense of being safe or being at home, safety, or being a home, or fullness. You know, these are how this is the form that this awareness usually takes. You suddenly have this profound sense of well-being or safety, or it's like being home, like going home. And when this happens, what's really occurring is the activation of this other deeper mind, which experiences the world as a whole, not as pieces, you know. And this experience of wholeness is usually accompanied by, sometimes by joy, sometimes by a kind of buoyant energy, by energy. And this is like medicine for your mind, being in this place. Because, you know, if you live exclusively in the discriminating mind, or more or less in the discriminating mind, it's very difficult to hang on to a sense of trust, a trust. And human beings live by trust, live by trust. I came out of the bathroom the other day. I took a shower in the one of the dorms. And I sat in the lounge there, and I picked up a National Geographic. And I thought, oh, the latest National Geographic. But then I noticed it was 1988. And I thought, oh, I think I remember this one, you know. And it had an article on physics, the latest 1988 physics. And they were talking about black holes. And they were talking about how galaxies like ours can get sucked into a black hole. And it was saying the whole galaxy is drawn into this black hole, and it, you know, it showed a picture of a galaxy being sucked into a big black hole. And it says, as you approach the event horizon, you know, all the subatomic particles are torn to pieces, and, you know, it must hurt, you know. And I thought, wow, that's really... Thank God that's not happening today, you know. That's the kind of universe we live in, you know. One day there's a new universe, a new... actually, that's the kind of cosmos we live in, right? One day there's a new universe, and then it's into the black hole, and then I think a new, fresh universe pops out, you know. And so, you know, how do you, you know, you don't have to take it up to that scale. You know, if you people I know and care about very much, you know, things can happen to them unexpectedly, you know, and they wind up in the hospital, you know. So, if you try to resolve these issues with your discriminating mind, you just drive yourself absolutely crazy, because it actually has the effect of probably of undermining. Undermining trust, you know. The more you know, there's the discriminating mind is good to a point, right? You know, so you know, if you're a doctor, you have your protocols. So somebody presents with a certain symptom, and you go through the protocol, you know, and it maybe it fits this, and then you go through this protocol, and then you. You know, prescribe this drug. You know, but if you, you know, it's possible to, no symptom is a pure symptom. You know, they all present in their own way. So, probably none of them exactly fit the protocol. You know, and so there's always an element of uncertainty or an element of risk in everything. And when the discriminating mind tries to deal with that, it tries to have certainty. Right, it tries to get to certainty by reasoning its way through, you know. But this very seldom works. You know, people become a little bit neurotic, right? You may know that baseball players are actually deeply neurotic. You know, I was reading something about how ball players. Basically, if they hit the ball, if you're a hitter and you're pitched a ball, and you hit it. And especially if it's a good hit, but baseball players try to duplicate what they did again. So they'll think back, what did I do today? You know, well, when I came out of the shower, I forgot my deodorant. So after that, you know, no deodorant, right? Every time they're going up to hit, you know, going to play. Or they took their rosary, I mean their crucifix out of their shirt and looked at it, and then they went up to bat. So every time now they go to bat, they pull a crucifix out and look at it. Or they took the bat and hit it on their cleats, right? Three times. So every time they make a little ritual out of it, right? They're trying to control the situation in this way, you know. And so much of what we do is like that, right? It has this slightly neurotic character. Sometimes it becomes unhealthy, right? I mean, people become obsessive compulsive. They develop phobias, you know, and so on, because their trust in life is eroded, you know. You can have traumatic events, you know. Maybe you have to give an academic paper, and you give the paper, and somebody jumps up and starts attacking it, and you know, the next time you go to give a paper, you might be really nervous, like you're waiting for somebody, for that same person to show up and attack you, you know. So, believe it or not, this actually happened to me. Many, many years ago, I criticized somebody's work in writing. I was writing a book review, and there was a collection of essays by a bunch of scholars, and I criticized this guy's work. His name was Donald. I'll give you his first name. And he's long retired now. But he took it really personally, really personally. And he would follow me when I was giving papers, and he would always stand up and challenge me. And he'd always try to, you know, attack what I was saying. It was a little bit scary. You know, I thought he might try to shoot me or something, you know. I hadn't really been cruel to him. I had just criticized something he argued, you know, and he took it really, and he would follow me, you know. And people I know would say, oh yeah, I saw Donald. He was telling me what a terrible person you are, you know, this sort of thing. You know, he couldn't let it go, you know. Well, basically I had hurt his feelings. And I asked him, I met with him, and I said, well, what would make this right? And he said, I want you to write a public apology saying that you completely were wrong. And I said, well, I can't do that, you know. So he couldn't let it go. You know, it had become like almost like an obsession for him, you know. So probably whenever he heard my voice, he would just start shaking with rage, you know. This is somebody who's lost trust in life, right? It's partly about me, but it's really about losing trust in life. And so when we have these moments where we feel safe, this sense of well-being and connectedness, and it's arising spontaneously, it's not something we're reaching for consciously, this is a hugely positive. It's the most important thing that people can get from a sesshin, is the renewal of trust in life, right? There's a kind of trust which is mind which is able to go from moment to moment in this trusting way. See, when you fall into discriminating thought, the trust often disappears. But if you can stay in this big mind, in this connected intelligence, you go from moment to moment in this trusting mode, in this mode that's like safe or connected or bright. This bright mind. Each moment of this trusting mind is really like laying the foundation for a new and better life. You know, it's the world really is our home, and often we feel homeless because, let's face it, people do things sometimes that are threatening or make us feel uneasy. Sometimes they want to do that. But Zen is all about cultivating a trusting mind, this big mind, this unconscious connected mind. And sesshin is like going, trying to go from moment to moment to moment to moment in this trusting mode. And in this way, you're undoing a lot of negative karma. You know, you're undoing a lot of phobias, fears, compulsions that are caused by injuries that have been done to us, you know, including by people who love us, you know. So sesshin is really very important in this way. Being mindful is in itself quite healing and positive. But the cultivation of trust can't really be done, I think, consciously. You know, if you're nervous, you know, I have a friend of mine who has a phobia about going over a bridge. You know, years ago he was driving over the Chesapeake Bridge and his hand started to shake. And this is somebody who witnessed his father's attempted suicide when he was a boy. He came in and his father had tried to kill himself, and my friend found his dad in like the pool of blood on the floor. And my friend has always denied that it had any effect on him, which seems very unlikely, right? You know, but he was driving across the Chesapeake Bay, you know, bridge, that long, long bridge, and his hands began to shake, and he had to pull over, and his wife had to drive. And this is somebody who, you know, at some level, his trust has been damaged, you know. And, you know, a therapy is very positive, and usually it involves a relationship of trust with the therapist, right? And if you have a therapist you don't trust, you probably will stop going, because everything depends on the therapist being able to knit the world back together for you in a way that elicits trust, you know. But Zazen is like this too. It's all about trusting the world, you know, finding this trusting mind. And you can't say, oh, I must trust. I must be more trusting, you know. That's not going to work. What we do is we sit on the cushion and we let the discriminating mind begin to calm down and stop dominating our attention. And we begin to experience the world in this other non-verbal, non-conceptual mode, which is very deeply connected. And in this way, we restore our sense of trust in things. So, Lin Ji was a wonderful Zen teacher. The kind of Zen we do is called Lin Ji or Rinzai Zen. And Lin Ji was teaching at a time when Chinese people had been through like hell. Basically, they had had a period of political and cultural collapse, and basically millions of people died as a result. You know, and also ordinary people in China at this time. China was like very hierarchical society, so you know there were a small number of very very elite, powerful people. Who were very well educated, and there were large masses of people who were like peasants, you know. And the educated people made the uneducated poor people feel like dirt. And the society had really was in a really sort of like you could say unhealthy state. The whole society was traumatized, and people who had resources were preying on or taking advantage of those who had no resources, as often happens in difficult times, you know. So Lin Ji was really trying to tell people there's this mind of trust. You need, everything depends on, we live by trust, right? We can't even get out of bed in the morning if we don't trust, you know. And universes slide into black holes every day, but somehow, we can actually go through life with great energy and joy. It's possible, you know. How do you do that, you know? Well, trust. And it's you can't say, okay, I'll trust. You have to find connectedness to the world, on the cushion and off the cushion. And if you're really deeply connected to the world, if you have this really intimate, loving relationship with the world, then a trust springs up automatically. It's like the baby's trust for its mother, you know, or the child's trust for its father, you know. So Linji said to the assembly, there is a true person of no rank always going in and out through the portals of your face. In other words, you're breathing, right? The breath goes in and the breath goes out. There's a kind of consciousness which is, he says, a person of no rank. See, and in China at this time, it was very important to have prestige and to have a high prestige career, basically. And people who didn't have high prestige careers felt like dirt, and people who had them felt like they had a right to treat other people like dirt. You know. So Linji said, look, don't envy the powerful. Don't envy people who have more wealth than you. Don't envy people who are on television, you know. Right now, the secret to a healthy, happy life is available to you in the trusting mind. And he says, there's a person with no rank always going in and out through the portals of your face. Just follow the breath, one by one, breath by breath, and your discriminating mind will calm down, and you'll discover this other connected mind. And when you find that, your relationship to the world will change, and the world will change for you. And he said, if you haven't yet witnessed this, keep going, keep sitting. Then a monk came forward, and he says, with his discriminating intellect, come on, you know, what is this person of no rank? So he doesn't know how to enter into this other holistic consciousness, right? And Linji grabs him. Linji got down from his seat, grabbed him. The monk hesitated. So, because the monk is not in a trusting state, he's unable to act spontaneously. You know, he second-guessed himself. He paralyzed himself with anxiety. See? And so, he's trapped in doubt, not just self-doubt, but doubt about the world. And so, when Linji jumps down off the seat and he is about to grab you, you should probably slap his face, you know, or do something, right? And this is a wonderful opportunity to enter into a play with the universe, right? So when a Zen master tries to grab you, you should definitely squeeze his nose or something like that. Or something, you know, do something. You know. But this guy's frozen with lack of trust, right? So Linji pushed him away and says, the true man of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. He's not saying to this guy, you're a piece of dried crap. He's saying, you've already formed a concept you formed a concept already of a man of no rank, and it's preventing you from being in that holistic mindset, you know. He's saying, look, you know, I didn't mean to set up another unattainable goal for you. He came in and he said, look, don't worry about setting up unattainable goals. Be a person of no rank. Just be spontaneous. Let your unconscious out of the box, you know. And this guy says, oh, I want to be a person of no rank. And he creates a concept of it, and it imprisons him again. So Linji said, okay, let go of that idea too. You know, let's forget about person of no rank, you know. Let's forget that too. So Linji is trying to help him get to this non-discriminating mind, which is not concept-bound, and in order to experience a trust that would allow him to act spontaneously in the world. So that sounds nice, doesn't it? That sounds like something that would be nice. So everybody is here doing zazen. You've all come to Sesshin to experience this non-discriminating, holistic mind, and to return to your oneness with the world. The word Sesshin means to unify, And what are we unifying? We're unifying with the world, with the way things are. So this is a practice of unification. Zen, the word Zen actually means, jhana really could be translated as fusion, right? Or reuniting. You know. So if this is your day three, I'm hoping things are really going well for you. I think they probably are. And if this is your day one, you know, hang on to your hats. Interesting things are going to happen. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Flowers don't have to think about it. You know, it's spring and they all just open up naturally. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and sand can't be cleared away, clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring. If suddenly it bursts forth, it would flow freely. That's sort of how we are, right? If we, in our daily lives, we become like a blocked spring, right? There's this wonderful life-giving water, but it can't flow freely because of lack of trust. And we get blocked in various ways. And it can take a long time to get through our blocks. You know, it can take years, depending on the blocks. But this is really the path of healing and liberation. And if you keep going, you know, your block is going to fall apart, and there's going to be this wonderful life energy flowing like a spring. So that's what the koan is telling you. And I think it's true. So let's practice wholeheartedly in the hours to come.